All right, for our 5 o'clock presentation, it is Not Camp Anson, Historical Memory and Camp Anson's Colorline Legacy by Zachary Mosier. And here he is.
All right, my name is Zach. Thank you for being here. I'm going to talk a little bit about Camp Anson today and how his legacy's changed. The Jackie Robinson story remains one of the most vivid parables in the American consciousness, popular memory embodied in films like 42, and a surplus of tales for children and adults alike, often pairs the courageous, stoic Robinson with the Christian good of Branch Rickey, a memory whose history is easily traced back to journalistic accounts contemporary of Robinson's career. Conversely, as Robinson and Rickey became the moral bulwarks of organized baseball's popular integration narrative, writers and fans alike sought the narrative antithesis of these men, and many readily attributed the creation of the color line almost wholly to Chicago player manager Cap Anson. My research analyzes the long evolution of Cap Anson's legacy vis-a-vis baseball's color barrier, from his immediate exaltation of the pantheon of early baseball stars, through the reassessment spurred by the integration era's desire for a moral framework, to the critical historical reinterpretation prevalent since the 1970s. I hope not only to arrive at an understanding of Anson's role in the creation of the color line, but also to illuminate the mechanisms of popular memory, how we think about these stories, and the production of historical narratives, how and why we tell some of the stories we tell. Today I'm going to profile a few journalists' work and some historical accounts that offer a variety of interpretations of Anson's legacy, and that illustrate the long arc of his legacy. So first, a few details on Anson's career. Most of you are familiar with Anson. He was born in Iowa in 1852 in Marshalltown. He showed promise as a young ball player, and like many 19th century players, he signed a contract in 1870 as a teenager after impressing the local professional team, Rockford Forest City, who they were playing in an exhibition game. After stints in Rockford and Philadelphia, Anson signed with the Chicago White Stockings, later the Cubs, of course, where he became the 19th century's biggest baseball star, collecting around 3,000 hits and capturing 6 National League pennants as a player and manager. He eventually owned stock in the team in the early 1890s and allied himself with ownership in their frequent battles in that era with players, stumping for better contracts, notably campaigning against the Players League in 1890. He eventually retired in 1897 after a long career as the oldest player in the league. He was briefly and unsuccessfully the manager of the New York Giants, but after that he held no job in professional baseball until he died in 1922. In his retirement, about 25 years, he formed barnstorming clubs. He achieved notoriety as a great bowler, and he performed on stage in vaudeville shows touring the country, and he refused nearly all help offered to him when he found himself in dire financial straits. At the time of his death, he had enjoyed decades of fame as a baseball star and a paragon of 19th century professionalism, bound as it was by particular notions of whiteness and masculinity, which I'll talk a little bit about. This would all be fine and well, but Anson also espoused the tenets of white supremacism during his playing career. In a late summer game in 1883, Anson's club was set to play against him, the new Toledo American Association entry. That Toledo club featured Moses Fleetwood Walker, who many of you might recognize as perhaps the most well-known of 19th century black ball players. To that point, Walker had surmounted many of the obstacles that one can imagine confronted a black player in a predominantly white league in the 19th century. But that day, against Anson, he faced a tough challenge. Although Walker was not supposed to take the field due to a sore hand, he was a catcher at the time, the Chicago team, headed by Anson, refused to play a team fielding a black player, according to the Toledo Daily Blade, the local paper. I'll read from that paper. Actually, I don't have the slide, so you'll have to take my word for it. So there are several accounts of Anson's actions on this day. By the end of the decade, every professional league had effectively barred players from participating, most notably the International League in 1887, which at the time included black pitcher George Stovey. And so Walker, Stovey, and Frank Grant, who had all played at times and excelled on mostly white teams and leagues, found themselves without teams by the end of the decade. In Anson's retirement and in the few years after his death, in the 1920s and 30s, Those with the power to shape the game's past and present either forgot or chose to forget Anson's racism. There weren't a lot of sources available to them, actually, in the 1920s and 30s about these events. In Anson's New York Times obituary, newly minted Commissioner Landis mourned the erstwhile White Stocking, exclaiming, "Not Pop Anson. You don't mean my old friend Pop is dead? Oh, I just can't say anything," to give you a sense of how revered he was at the time of his death. But for a striking example of that level of respect that Anson received, we'll take a, I'll read from a 1912 column from the Chicago Defender, which was the city's black newspaper, praising inside baseball, or what we would call small ball. The Defender reveres Anson as a paradigm of how the game should be played. Interestingly, the paper cast Anson as a relic of the 19th century. Remember, this is only 1912, not too many years removed. But it's far, he was far removed from contemporary baseball. The paper undoubtedly was not aware of the segregationist exploits. Sources referring to those incidents were pretty scarce, or non-existent. It's difficult to tell, of course. But by using him as an example of a bygone era, it unwittingly contributed to the growing chasm between Anson and the contemporary game. In 1939, the Old Timers Committee, which kind of evolved into the Veterans Committee, elected Anson to the Baseball Hall of Fame. However, as integration became a subject of greater debate and campaigning in the 1930s and 40s, several sports writers began to uncover Anson's 19th century racism. And they employed the Anson story as a rhetorical tool in their pursuit of black American reentry into organized baseball. We're going to zero in on two writers, both with Chicago ties that played a major role in the process. Fay Young and Doc Young, of no relation, each profiled early black ball players. They wrote at times for the influential Chicago Defender, and they each pushed for African-American integration of Major League Baseball. While chronicling this pivotal era, the integration era, each used Anson as a narrative device, a readily available tool in their moral case for integration. 7 years before Jackie Robinson's signing in 1938, Fay Young documented the existence of a gentleman's agreement, the euphemism often used for the systematic exclusion of blacks from organized baseball in the 19th century. He recounts, "Those who remember old Cap Anson, the Chicago White Stockings, remember the Chicagoan kicked up a hornet's nest when he found a player not white in uniform and being used as a regular." Young wrote these words in the same paper that lauded Anson's play a quarter century earlier, the Chicago Defender. In April of 1947, the month of Robinson's Dodgers debut, Young wrote a typical column about how Jackie wasn't technically the first black American to play in white organized baseball. He referenced Stovey and Walker. Again, Anson figured prominently in the story. Young writes, "When it was learned by Cap Anson that Charlie Grant was a Negro, Anson became rambunctious and refused to play his team against a club with a Negro on it." Doc Young, on the other hand, he wrote for the Defender and the LA Sentinel, Jet, Ebony, and a lot of nationally syndicated publications until his death in the 1990s, 1995, I believe. He similarly wrote in February 1957, "Did You Know" column about Moses Fleetwood Walker and George Stovey, and he condemned Anson even more wholly than Fay Young did. To quote Young at length, "Powerful Cap Anson, leader of the Chicago White Stockings, objected. For reasons he never made clear, Anson was violently opposed to integration of baseball. He let loose such a howl throughout the league that John Montgomery Ward, the person signing Stovey, was forced to abandon his plan." Montgomery Ward had initially planned to sign Stovey from the Newark minor league team. Later in the same column, Young claims, "By constant campaigning and standing relentlessly, Anson fathered Jim Crow in baseball, which lasted until Ricky made his move." With the added significance of tangible integration, this is, Jackie Robinson had debuted and others were on their way, Dockham simultaneously affirmed the moralist role of Branch Rickey in the Robinson signing, and that became a key portion of Young's narrative. But he also lambasted the three decades that sees Anson for single-handedly establishing the color line. Doc Young's investment in Robinson's story is unsurprising. He covered Robinson's career and championed integration throughout, going so far as to take some credit for the Cubs signing of Gene Baker. But he consequently oversimplified the Anson story. Young's other writings helped him frame his growing disdain for Anson. In 1948, a year after Robinson debuted, he unleashed a scathing criticism of conditions in Negro League baseball in an article ghostwritten for Jackie Robinson in Ebony entitled What's Wrong with Negro Baseball? This is a very famous article. His numerous books on black sports stars demonstrated a steadfast goal of increasing awareness of black athletic excellence and black athletes' fitness for competition with whites. Dozens of articles like these exist, populating the pages of newspapers and other periodicals throughout the immigration era, 30s and 40s and 50s, a testament to these writers' desire to deliver that immigration message with a certain kind of moral potency. There are some direct threads from Anson's racist and transcendence in the 19th century to Ricky's bold move to sign Jackie Robinson. Now for an even starker portrait of this kind of developing hero-villain narrative, we can turn to the sporting news on the actual day of Robinson's signing in October of 1945. The relatively conservative St. Louis-based sporting news featured a page with a large picture of Robinson up top. Unfortunately, I can't show it to you right now. And he's flanked by four white executives, including Branch Rickey and his son. This was accompanying a story profiling Robinson and chronicling the signing. And that story about Robinson signing literally straddled a few short paragraphs that were titled 20 Negroes Played in Minors in 87. And I think that's a conscious juxtaposition. In the column therein dramatized Anson's refusal to play teams for fielding black players. And I'll read from that. By a strange quirk of fate, it was an incident that happened during an exhibition game between Pop Anson's Chicago Colts and the Newark Little Giants that figured in ending Stobie and Walker's careers. The Colts came to the old Wright Street Oval, and when the colored Newark batter walked out on the field, Anson rushed over and asked manager Charlie Hackett, "What is this, Mr. Hackett? I'm pulling my team off the field." Hackett threatened to withhold Chicago's guarantee, but the 4,000 fans were growing restless, and the Newark manager finally consented to put in a white batter. The affair had repercussions the same fall after Hackett's ace pitcher had a remarkable record. John Montgomery Ward, the famous lawyer and shortstop and then head of the New York Giants, tried to buy Stobie, but Anson spotted the deal and blocked it. That's all from that sporting news article. So while not as fierce as Doc Young's accounts had become, the sporting news still traded in the same Anson stories and implicit comparisons to the Ricky Robinson moral narrative that was developing. Doc Young continued to write the sports pages of Anson's intransigence with rhetorical flair in the 60s and 70s, so after kind of what is known as the immigration era, that time mostly with the LA Sentinel. In 1965, Young wrote about Ernie Banks eclipsing Anson's club record for extra base hits, which was a momentous occasion. Seizing on that opportunity to again discuss Anson's racist exploits and lay bare the absurdity of white supremacism as he saw it. Doc Young writes that Anson's dehydrated corpse was swirling in its grave because a black player had served his extra base hit crown. Young also asserts things were coming along right well on the major league integration front until Anson couldn't stand the sight of a brown body in a big-time uniform. Proceeding to state that no one knew why Anson hated blacks, he just did. At the end of the column, Young hurled unsavory epithets to the 19th century ball player, calling him a small man, calling him un-American, and a man probably churning in Hades right now. Not only did Young use that moral framework in the Anson narrative, but he invoked hell and explicit Christian morality and American values to scold him. So, like Doc Young, a number of prominent baseball writers in the 60s and 70s retold tales of Anson's racial hatred. Most notably, Willis Carter and several others of the Pittsburgh Courier, and Art Russ Jr. of the New York Amsterdam News and New York Daily News. Russ, the immensely popular sports radio personality and author of several books on black athletes, among other things, latched on to Anson's story in particular. And although he didn't shy away from many of the complex, tangled stories of black baseball, he eschewed complexity with regards to Anson's story. In 1976, he wrote, "Anson's great popularity and potency in baseball circles almost single-handedly sped up the exclusion of the black man from baseball until 1946. The image of Anson raising hell remained pretty salient for many, including Art Russ, into the 70s. So not all sports writers harbor the same feelings as these few about Anson. Ray Robinson, who was a white sports writer from the Chicago Tribune and the author of many popular baseball books, penned a May 1970 review of Robert Peterson's Only the Ball Is White, in which he lamented Hansen's role in the creation of the color line. Many revered figures in baseball emerged from this narrative with tainted reputations, Robinson writes. He alluded to Hansen's not only unexplainable but unforgivable hatred of blacks, and asserted that Hansen was instrumental in excluding blacks from the big leagues during the purge of the 1880s. While trading the same basic facts as Doc Young and others, Robinson's interpretation clearly differs greatly. His insistence on Hansen's racism is inexplicable, but denies any possible connection you could make between Hansen and any greater trends in the 19th century, which include, of course, further entrenched racism in baseball and other industries, and I think that's harmful and disingenuous claim. Tales of Hansen's virulence peppered stories throughout the integration era in the 60s and 70s, most often paired with that Robinson-Ricky story, and also Stovey and Walker stories. Writers explain the genesis of the gentleman's agreement and Hansen's role in its solidification, but rarely, if ever, attempt to contextualize Hansen as a post-Reconstruction figure, beholden to historical trends and the developing culture of baseball professionalism, predicated on black exclusion. Of course, many of these writers had the specific goal of integration in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s, and their columns were at the front line of that campaign, as Chris Lamb wonderfully highlights in his book. There were some historical corrections occurring in the early 1970s to the Hansen story, with the rediscovery of Saul White's History of Colored Baseball, the publication of Peterson's Only the Ball Is White, and the renaissance of interest in black baseball history that swept Sappho Page and others into the Hall of Fame. In his History of Colored Baseball, which was written in the first decade of the 20th century, it's really an incredible document, Saul White recounted his experiences in 19th century clubs. White's account of Hansen's racism in this volume is pretty remarkable, and it appears to be the blueprint from which many journalists in the 70s and onward, most notably Art Russ, built their Hansen stories. Within, White likened Hansen's racism to that of Pitchfork Ben Tillman, the white supremacist governor of South Carolina, and James Vardaman, the like-minded governor of Mississippi. White produced the Fleetwood Walker and George Stovey stories as proof and drew this conclusion. I'll read from it. Just why Adrian C. Hansen was so strongly opposed to colored players on white teams cannot be explained. His repugnant feeling shown at every opportunity toward colored players was a source of comment through every league in the country, and his opposition, with his great popularity and power in baseball circles, hastened the exclusion to the black man from the white leagues. Now, Robert Peterson, writing in the early 1970s, drew a lot from Saul White's Hansen stories and grappling with the beginnings of the color line in his book. Peterson's book is probably the most pivotal assessment of Hansen's role in the creation of the color line that we have in this long, long arc of assessment of and interpretation of Hansen's exploits. Peterson cited several sporting news articles written in the few years after these 1880s incidents with Hansen, and he told the story of Hansen and Stovey, noting that this triumph of race prejudice determining a manager's judgment was not, however, the first or last attempt at racial segregation in organized baseball. I just quote from his book. Peterson instead of taking the story at face value and placing the blame upon Hansen for the color barrier wholly, rather contextualized the Stovey and Walker incidents and created a more complete picture of the complex process of segregation that was going on. He juxtaposed Saul White's indictment of Hansen with the larger trends of segregation going on, most notably the International League's 1887 decision to bar blacks. He calls it attrition, and he thinks that's how the nature of black participation in organized baseball at the time was like, waning. And that's particularly true in the International League and Ohio State League in the 1880s. In light of these developments in the 80s, Peterson asserts, and I'll read again, that Hansen had the power and popularity to force Negroes out of organized baseball almost single-handedly, as White suggests, is to credit him with more influence than he had, or for that matter, than he needed. For it seemed clear that the majority of professional ball players in 1887, both Northerners and Southerners, opposed integration in the game. Despite their success, the number of blacks in organized baseball dwindled as opposition became more heated from both players and the press. Black players abandoned the major leagues, and black baseball teams, including those for whom Saul White played, emerged. For Peterson, this process resulted not from Anson's actions, but from rapidly solidifying culture of racial hostility in the game of baseball. Characterizations of Anson as merely of his time became more rare in the last two decades of the 20th century and the first decade of the 21st century due to research done by scholars like Peterson, Jules Tigeal, and a whole host of others as baseball scholarship has really boomed, as we've seen, of course. And these scholars, since Peterson especially, have prioritized historical context and a reliance on newly available primary documents, including Saul Weick's History of Colored Baseball, instead of relying on sort of these mythical tales that kind of popped up. The relationship between historical context and Anson's individual actions have become the primary intellectual battleground for these scholars. On the other hand, Anson apologism, while having waned considerably, hasn't died out completely. About a decade ago, Howard Rosenberg self-published a several-volume biography of Anson that's more an exercise in hagiography and praising Anson than a real disciplined interpretation of these accounts that we have from Anson's career. Within that set of books, it's a couple volumes, he casts Anson as a figure deserving sympathy and fails to engage critically with the wealth of newspaper accounts about Anson's racism that he actually cites in the book. Rosenberg's books are perhaps the most extreme example of Anson apologism living, but writers regarding Anson as nothing more than an unfortunate man who was caught in his time, pop up very often. While Anson's racism did little to harm his reputation during his playing days, the emergence of Saul Weick's History of Colored Baseball, with its assailment of Anson and his role in the creation of the color line, defined how 20th century baseball writers and historians alike perceived Anson. Countless sports writers retold the tales of Anson's color line villainy, with his legend as the color line's chief instigator growing throughout the century as column after column relayed Anson's malicious racism. Nonetheless, Anson's plaque in the National Baseball Hall of Fame lacks any mention of that racism, merely heralding his on-field achievements and leadership skills. Likewise, the Hall of Fame's website contains no mentions of these exploits. Similar to Ty Cobb, and of course we're all thinking about Ty Cobb too, Anson's legacy is in some ways still undergoing revision with regards to segregation. Because his entire career unfolded before the onset of what we think is the modern game, that is, before the rise of the American League and the two-league system, and really before the solidification of the reserve clause as the labor system, it's easy to think of Anson in two-dimensional terms, either as a racist caricature deserving our whole condemnation, or as a racist caricature deserving of our sympathy. Throughout my research, what's become clear to me is that there's sometimes exists a kind of disconnect with how we think about the color line, actually, of the tendency to chop it into sections with little to no thematic glue. To the integration era writers first discovering Anson's racism, Anson himself was a kind of shorthand for the creation of the color barrier, a distant past easily scolded for its backwardness. Of course, no matter Anson's role in the formation of the color line, he was certainly not responsible for maintaining that exclusionary principle once his career ended. When those writers began to leave the Anson story behind as a tool for talking about integration, they more pointedly critiqued the ongoing process of black exclusion employed by current executives in the 40s and 50s. Historians like Chris Landon meticulously documented these tactics. Some of my other research focuses on the actual continuity between and differences between Anson and the next generation of white players and executives who did maintain the color barrier. In this way, Anson's story is itself an integral piece in the overarching story of baseball's integration process. Like other strands of baseball's complex integration story, many have treated it with one eye to Robinson and Rickey's own moral accomplishments, glossing over the relationship between Anson and baseball's cultural push toward a 19th century professional ideal that excludes blacks. Anson's refusals to play teams fielding George Stovey and Fleetwood Walker captures the intense hostility towards blacks emerging in the early game. As leagues folded frequently, teams struggled to retain their players, capital proved scarce, and owners attempted to appeal to an audience used to associating the game of baseball with recreation and not professionals. The cycles of interpretation and reinterpretation evident in the treatment of Anson's story reflect shifting understandings of baseball's larger integration narrative. Baseball, one of America's most important cultural institutions, instituted a color barrier in the 19th century, refused entry to even the most talented black players for over half a century. Cap Anson's role in the creation of that barrier has existed as a key chapter of the integration story through baseball's formative years, through Jackie Robinson's career and the difficult process of integration, And now, for the post-integration era, journalists, historians, and fans of the game must still interpret Hansen's story in order to create a more complete integration narrative.